Cliff Denny, your host of Earth Ancients, startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past. It's Saturday, March 22nd, 2014, and it is sunny here in Oakland, California. For you listeners outside of the United States, Earth Ancient now is available on as a podcast on iTunes. I've made it free for everyone, so all you need to do is go into the iTunes store, do a search for Earth Ancients podcast, and you will find it there available to download, or you can actually listen to it on whatever device you have. I've been wanting to do this. I didn't realize it took 2 weeks to actually get it released. They have to do an approval. And so now it's international, and there's no need to go to the Blog Talk Radio to do that. This week on Facebook, I featured a couple of different articles, and I'm going to mention just two here before we go to our guest. The first one was a post on equinox structures. In other words, ancient structures that registered and logged the equinox. And the most well-known is in Yucatan, Mexico, which is in the ancient site of Chichen Itza, Mayan ruin, and the pyramid, which the Spanish named El Castillo. And that monument actually registers the equinox by the appearance of the snake or the serpent, which is seen on the stairwell leading down to the head of a serpent. We had a huge group of interest from that. What I didn't know was that in Angkor Wat in Cambodia, there is another structure. It's the central tower where the sun rises on the side and then appears at the very top. Another thing which I reported, which I actually found out only about a month ago, is that that building was once Hindu and then was later converted. So that was of interest to me. So I had a big out call for more of that information, and I've posted an additional series of photos. Also, the news on Shorya, Siberia, and the discovery of those ancient megalithic ruins. I have posted a couple of different articles on that site, and I have not gotten verification from the geologists that were on that party if it is man-made or not. It appears to be man-made. And if it is, then we're talking about the largest human megalithic structure in the world, significantly bigger than Stonehenge or any of the other known megaliths in the world. The exploration team discovered that place in Shorya, Russia, in 2013, last year. And we still have, I believe they're going to be going back out there this coming summer to do surveys. And then when they do the survey and possibly some satellite studies, I think it'll be, you know, proven to be either man-made or not. There's a lot of natural rock formations that kind of appear to be man-made, but are actually natural. And I've had a couple of geologists call and describe the what they think Shorya is as man-made. Dr. Robert Schock, who with John Anthony West redated the Sphinx in the Giza Plateau, is not quite sure, and so he's actually going to be our resource for a definitive study on the Shorya megaliths. So our next guest, Michael Cremo, is an American researcher who identifies himself as a Vedic creationist and argues that humans have lived on Earth for billions of years. He is a member of the History of Science Society, the World Archaeological Congress, the Philosophy of Science Association and the European Association of Archaeologists. He is the principal author of Forbidden Archaeology, which is, I must be sold in the millions now, we'll ask him in a minute here, and which is a comprehensive survey of archaeological evidence consistent with Vedic accounts of extreme human antiquity. He's also the author of Human Deevolution, My Science, My Religion, and I believe there was a follow-up to Forbidden Archaeology, which is called The Hidden History of Human Race, which is, I think, a smaller version. But anyhow, Michael, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Cliff, and all your listeners.
Yes. Your work is fascinating. Your books have the first book has been out for at least 20 years, I believe, hasn't it? Has it reached a 20-year period
yet?
Yeah, it's
about that. It was published. Forbidden Archaeology was first published in 1993, so it's
okay.
A little over 20 years now. Yeah.
Yes, I was just mentioning to Michael offline that I noticed a number of Facebook pages that are devoted to Forbidden Archaeology, and I think people are trying to take what you have written and also post what they have found in various other parts of the country and the world, actually. So, Michael, tell us what a Vedic creationist is and how you, with your background, perceive history.
Well, the Vedas are the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. Veda is a Sanskrit word. It means knowledge. And, you know, the Vedic texts contain lots of information about lots of different topics, cosmology, history, meditation, yoga, a lot of stuff. But I was particularly interested in the things that had to do with the history of life on this planet. Actually, it was in the ancient Sanskrit writings that I first encountered the idea that humans like us have been present on Earth for many millions of years. That's what got me started doing my research in forbidden archaeology to see if there was any archaeological evidence that was consistent with those ancient accounts of extreme human antiquity, and I found there were archaeological reports that are consistent with those ancient accounts. But that leads to another question. That evidence for extreme human antiquity, it contradicts the standard theories of human origins and the origin of species, namely the Darwinian evolutionary accounts. That means, you know, we need some other explanations for human origins and the origin of species. And the Vedic texts do give an account. And to really understand it, you have to, first of all, understand what a living thing is. Many people today will think that a human being or any other living thing is just a machine made of molecules, but I think there's more to it than that. Actually, the primary substance in a living thing is consciousness, I believe, not molecules. And I think that consciousness has an existence separate from matter. The conscious self is non-material. It has an origin that goes totally beyond anything material. And somehow or other, it's come in contact. You know, this non-material conscious self, which is the real self, it's who we really are. We're not these machines made of molecules that we call our bodies. The body is just a vehicle for the conscious self, which has a non-material origin. So the origin for that conscious self, which is individual, personal, and conscious, is, I believe, also individual, personal, and conscious. In other words, there is some kind of supreme conscious being who is responsible for the origin of consciousness and the origin of the bodily vehicles that conscious selves now occupy on this level of reality. So that's what I mean by being kind of a Vedic creationist, but it's something that's found in a lot of ancient wisdom traditions, not just the Vedic tradition. A lot of the ancient wisdom traditions in the world have the idea that we have an origin that goes beyond the world of matter, that there is some kind of conscious intelligence behind the whole manifestation of the material world that we perceive around us. So, but if since I'm taking my major inspiration from the Vedic texts, and they do involve an intelligence that's responsible for the order and complexity that we observe around us, I will accept the label of Vedic creationist.
Okay. It's interesting.
Maybe
because
more than you want to hear about on the topic.
No, it's fascinating because your perception of history is based on ancient, you know, Vedas, these texts, these Vedic literature, and I don't think people understand that, or they're not aware of your perception into history and why it's so much different than orthodox science. And that brings me to my next question about your book, Human De-Evolution. To my mind, de-evolution refers to collapse or backwards evolution. Are you saying that the current period that we're in is archaic, or how do you describe that title? I find it fascinating.
Okay. Yeah, I use the word devolution in a couple of different senses, and I'll explain them. In the first sense in which I use devolution is to refer to our nature as conscious beings. Today, many scientists think that consciousness is produced by chemicals in the brain. They would say when you organize the chemicals in the brain in a very complex way, they produce what we call consciousness, but only temporarily, only in association with the brain. They would say when the chemicals in the brain become disorganized at the time of death, there's no more consciousness. So what they're saying, basically, is that as conscious beings, we evolve up from matter. But I'm saying, no, matter does not produce consciousness. Consciousness has its existence independent of matter. It's originally existing on what I call the level of pure consciousness, but it can come down from that level and come into contact with matter and be limited by its material coverings. And that process by which the pure conscious self comes in contact with the covering energy of matter is what I call devolution. In other words, as conscious beings, we don't evolve up from matter. Rather, we devolve or come down from the level of pure consciousness into association with matter, but it's a process that can be reversed and consciousness can be restored to its original pure state. Now, another sense in which I use the word devolution has to do with the Vedic concept of cyclical time. We all have to deal with time cycles. We deal with the day and night cycle. During the day, we tend to be awake. At night, we go to sleep. We also deal with the seasonal cycle of spring, summer, fall, winter. We adjust our activities to the different seasons. Ancient people were aware of even larger cycles of time. The people of ancient India were aware of larger cycles of time called yugas, and there were four of them: Satya, Treta, Dwapara, and Kali. The Satya Yuga is an age of spirituality and truth and peace and harmony. It's followed by the Treta Yuga, where these qualities are reduced by about 25%. And then the next Yuga, the Dwapara Yuga, the good qualities are reduced by 50%. And finally, in Kali Yuga, the age in which we now live, the good qualities are diminished by 75%, going down to zero. And we kind of see that trend in society today. We see increasing environmental and social disturbances all over the world, and it's going to get worse. So that's another sense in which I use the word devolution, in the sense of the degrading of human qualities that goes on in this cycle of yugas. Another sense in which I use the word devolution has to do with reincarnation. I accept the fact of reincarnation, and this means understanding that the conscious self is actually different than the bodily vehicle it now occupies. When the body we have now dies, the conscious self does not die. It continues to exist, and it will get another bodily vehicle according to its level of consciousness. And if a person has a high level of consciousness, their next bodily vehicle will be another human vehicle. They'll have an opportunity to continue trying to become more and more enlightened. But if a person has misused the human form of life, then in their next life, they may not get a human body. They may get a bodily vehicle of a lower kind, of a plant or an animal or something like that. And in that sense, the conscious self, it can either evolve upward through the process of reincarnation, or it can devolve or go down in the process of reincarnation.
So thank you're describing basically, you're describing karma, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So if so that's interesting. Go ahead. I'm interested in this.
Yeah, but the main sense in which I use the word devolution is that as conscious beings, we have not evolved up from matter. We have devolved or come down from a level of pure consciousness to which we're meant to return, and that's the actual purpose of human life, from which we become distracted because of too much materialism in our current worldwide human culture. I mean, basically, we're being told now we're just machines made of molecules in competition with each other for survival. So I think ideas like that are part of the cause of the environmental destruction that we see in the world. They also underlie the intense levels of conflict that we see in the world today, conflict among individuals, conflict among classes, conflict among races, conflict among nations, conflict among religions. I think a lot of it, not all of it, but some of it can be traced back to this concept that's being pounded into people's heads in the education system, that we're machines made of molecules in competition with each other for survival.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me, based on your understanding, what was the early human being like millions of years ago? Were they physical beings with this amazing consciousness? Do you have any source, or do the Vedic writings describe the original human?
Well, the Vedic texts do describe that in different cycles of time, different yugas, human nature was different. In the Satya Yuga, humans lived for long periods of time. They were all very healthy. They were all very spiritually aware. They were living up to 100,000 years.
And, oh, my God.
And actually, that people lived longer and past ages is something you find in a lot of different ancient wisdom traditions. It's there in the Bible. It's there in a lot of the ancient wisdom texts that in previous ages, you know, people did live longer. So, but these cycles, they repeat. You know, according to the Vedic text, originally people were living a very simple, natural life in harmony with nature. They did not divide themselves into competing groups. They were not living in cities. They were living in beautiful gardens and living in harmony with nature and living in peaceful harmony with each other. But when the next age comes, the Treta Yuga, they start becoming a little more materialistic, dividing themselves into classes and groups and nations and things like that, getting involved in competition, but still with some very high moral principles. They also begin to live maybe 10,000 years instead of 100,000 years. And then in the next age, called Dwapara Yuga, they live for 1,000 years. Things become a little more competitive and materialistic. And then finally, we get to the age where we're living now, Kali Yuga, where we live less than 100 years. Things are extremely materialistic. Things are extremely violent. The environment is becoming extremely polluted. But after the end of this Kali Yuga, there'll be another Satya Yuga, another golden age, and the cycle repeats again and again and again and again. So it kind of, just like the year, you go through the seasons again and again and again. There's a winter, spring, summer, fall, but then there's another winter, spring, summer, fall. It kind of goes on like that. But as I said, these ancient people were aware of these vaster cycles of time, which also repeat.
So how much, how many hundreds of thousands of years more do we have to pass before we go into a more aware level of humanity?
Based on the
yugas?
At any time, any individual, I'm talking about the general trend of the age. I mean, any individual can become more aware at any point, just by exercising his or her own free will to do so. And you can try to create little bubbles of enlightenment by getting like-minded people together. That can be done at any time. It can be done even now, although it's very difficult because it means going against the whole trend of the age. But just like if winter time is coming, it doesn't mean you have to freeze to death. You can keep yourself warm, you can keep your family warm, you can keep your friends warm. So the chance to become a little bit enlightened is always there. But as in terms of the general trend of the age, according to the Vedic cosmological calendar, the age of Kali, this age of extreme materialism that we're now living in, began about 5,000 years ago. It lasts for 432,000 years, so that means it's got another 427,000 years to go. And if we think things are bad now, it's not going to get any better.
Oh my God.
Unless substantial numbers of people exercise their free will in such a way that takes them more on the path of enlightenment, going against the general trend of the age.
Interesting. And enlightenment would be meditative practices, more conscious awareness of environment, things like that, correct?
Yeah, well, and understanding things like, okay, we're all beings of pure consciousness. We're all coming from the same source. There's no sense in dividing ourselves into competing groups so that we can be exploited by people who want to manipulate the competition for their own benefit. If people understood, hey, we're all beings of pure consciousness, we're all coming from the same source, that would solve a lot of the world's problems. It would solve a lot of the problems related to dividing ourselves into so many competing groups. It would also solve a lot of the environmental problems, because we'd be thinking our main purpose in life isn't to just continually produce and consume more and more material things. Our main business is to develop the resource of consciousness and we should be trying to satisfy our material needs, which we do have in this world, in the most simple, natural, and efficient way possible. So those are the kinds of things that I think enlightenment would involve.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, so based on your research, I've asked your assistant to provide me with Michael Cremo's top five smoking guns for human antiquity. And I think these items are taken from all your books, but I'm curious as to the specifics on five of them, and I think you have them in front of you. So you say, based on your research, that the human beings, humans like we are today, human sapien, is about 100 million years old, or is it more than that?
More than that. Like today, most scientists would say the first humans like us appeared less than 200,000 years ago on Earth. And before that,
right,
they would say there weren't any humans like us. There were just more primitive ape-like human ancestors going back maybe 6 or 7 million years, and then primitive apes and monkeys going back 40 million years or so, and before that, just maybe small little mammals, and before that, just reptiles, before that, just amphibians, before that, just fish, and before that, just single-celled creatures living in the ocean. Yeah, they have their whole picture. But
right, and that's all based on Darwin's theory of natural selection and so
yeah.
on and so forth, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a Darwinistic approach, and that's how current science dates man, is based on the theory
yeah.
that man was a stupid ape. Before that, it was a single-cell amoeba moving up into fish, reptiles, so on and so forth. And then the apes appeared. And then through an evolutionary process, ape-man developed a bigger brain and so forth.
Yeah,
and
with
then,
the first humans
okay.
like us appearing about 200,000 years ago, they would say. But
okay.
According to the Vedic texts, humans have always existed on Earth, going back many millions of years right to the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth. And this is something you find in a lot of different ancient wisdom traditions, not just the Vedic text. It's part of the understanding that comes from most of the major spiritual traditions of the world. So I was just wondering, is there any archaeological evidence for that humans like us have existed for millions of years? So I found, if you actually look at the original scientific reports, not at what you see in the textbooks today, but if you dig back into the original scientific reports, there's a lot of evidence, a lot of reports showing that humans like us existed millions of years ago. And, we could go over, the five cases that illustrate that, if you like.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, let's, and there's so much in forbidden archaeology. I mean, it's a
other hundreds
encyclopedic. Yeah. I have to ask you on the side note, did you base any of your work on Corliss's Ancient Man, A Handbook of Puzzling Artifacts? I have that book, and it's filled with similar types of documents. Are you familiar with that book?
Yes, I am. I think Corliss did a good job. If you look in the references that I cite in Forbidden Archaeology, if you go back to the bibliography, in other words, you'll mm-hmm. see that he's mentioned as a source of some of the cases that mm-hmm. We included in Forbidden Archaeology.
Okay, so let's go to the Michael Cremo's top five smoking guns, and number one is the California gold mine discoveries dating discoveries of items 50 million years. So let's, why don't you describe that?
Well, yeah, this is a case that's always really fascinated me. I mean, during the gold rush days, miners came to California And, you know, they were digging tunnels into the sides of mountains to get the gold, mountains like Table Mountain in the Sierra Nevada Mountains and near the town of Sonora. And deep inside the tunnels in the solid rock, the miners were finding human bones and human artifacts. They were finding obsidian, spear points, stone mortars and pestles, things like that. And these were all collected by the state geologist of California, Dr. J.D. Whitney, who published a big report about them. It was published by Harvard University in the year 1880. What makes these discoveries so interesting to me is they were found in layers of solid rock that modern geologists consider to be about 50 million years old. So it's really quite astonishing. As I said, most scientists today would say, you know, humans like us, capable of making things like that, didn't come into existence until about 200,000 years ago. But here we have a very important scientist, Dr. J.D. Whitney, reporting that human bones and human artifacts were found in layers of rock 50 million years old. Now, these things you will not see mentioned in the textbooks today. They're in the original scientific literature, but they're not in the textbooks today because of what I call a process of knowledge filtration. You know, the facts that fit the current theories, you'll see them in the textbooks, but the facts that don't fit the current theories, they get filtered out. And unless you're digging very deeply into these matters, you wouldn't even be aware that such evidence exists. But that's how effective the process of knowledge filtration is. You know, there was a contemporary of Dr. Whitney, another scientist, Dr. William Holmes of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. You know, he said if Dr. Whitney had understood the theory of human evolution, he wouldn't have published that report. In other words, he should have known these things can't possibly be true because they contradict the dominant theory. And according to Holmes, these things should have simply been forgotten, and basically that's what happened. But some of the artifacts from the California gold mines are still in the Museum of Anthropology of the University of California at Berkeley. And, you know, some years ago I was a consultant for a documentary that was shown on NBC called The Mysterious Origins of Man. And the producer of that show, a man named Bill Cote, had gotten a copy of my book, Forbidden Archaeology, and he wanted to include some cases from the book in the documentary. So I told him about these California gold mine discoveries, and I told him he should go to that museum at the University of California at Berkeley. When he went there, the museum officials refused to allow him to see the artifacts, what to speak of film them. So now later I did go back to the museum myself, and I was given permission to see them. They're not kept in the museum itself. They're kept in a storage building a few miles from the museum, but the artifacts are still there. And I have gone out into the Sierra Nevada mountains and relocated some of the old gold mining tunnels where these things were originally discovered. So it's a fascinating case. It's a pretty well-documented case as well.
Okay. Did you find any human skeletal remains in any documentation in any of the gold mines, or was it just their cookingware, stone flints, things like that?
There are reports. I was able to track down the stone artifacts and actually see them in museums. In Dr. Whitney's original reports, there are also reports of discoveries of human bones, human skulls, and things of that sort. Now, I haven't been able to track those down myself yet, but the search for them is ongoing.
Mm-hmm. So there is some reports
of it. But the human skeletal remains were reported in Dr. Whitney's reports that they had also been discovered.
Okay, interesting. Okay, number two from the Smoking Guns, the Latole footprints, which are dated to 3 million years. Would you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, this is yes, the California gold mine case comes from the 19th century. You know, and some people, for whatever reason, they think if evidence is old, there must be something wrong with it. I mean, they forget that Darwin was also a 19th century scientist, and they accept his ideas, you know. So it's not that all science that was done before the year 1900 is somehow or other wrong, but some people, they just have this misconception that, well, if a discovery was made in the 19th century, how can we believe it? It was so long ago. But, you know, this case from the Laetoli footprints is from more recent times. It comes from 1979 when Mary Leakey, a very famous archaeologist, discovered tracks of footprints at this place, which is in the country of Tanzania in East Africa. And she said in her original report in National Geographic magazine that the footprints are exactly like those of a modern human being. But the footprints are made in layers of solidified volcanic ash that are almost 4 million years old. They were dated using the potassium-argon method as being about 3,700,000 years old. And, I mean, basically what happened is, you know, 3 or 4 million years ago, there was a volcano erupting in that area, and it laid down some ash, and then there was some rain that kind of turned the ash to mud, and then some human beings, maybe trying to escape the volcano, were walking through that mud, and they left their footprints, which later solidified into solid rock and was uncovered by Mary Leakey in 1979. So you've got these human footprints, which she says are exactly like those of modern human beings, in layers of rock about almost 4 million years old. So that's really quite astonishing. That's another case that I think is pretty direct evidence that humans like us were existing millions of years ago on this planet.
Okay, interesting. Let's go to number three, because, let's see, the Castendaleo skulls, which date to 4 million years. What part of the world were they discovered?
Castendaleo is a village in the foothills of the Alps in northern Italy. And this discovery is significant because, say, somebody might say about the Laetoli footprints, okay, so you've got human footprints going back almost 4 million years. It would be better if you had human skeletons going back, you know, about 4 million years. And such things have been found and reported in the scientific literature. And the Castendaleo discoveries from northern Italy are one of these cases. This, again, was from the 19th century. An Italian geologist named Dr. Giuseppe Ragazzoni was making an excavation near Castendaleo. And below the surface of the ground, at about 6 feet deep, you know, he found human skeletons. And he determined that all the layers of rock above the skeletons were unbroken, undisturbed. Because one kind of counter explanation for these things is, well, maybe somebody a few thousand years ago dug a grave and put a body down in that ancient layer of rock, which is about 4 million years old, according to modern geologists. But the fact that all the layers of rock above the skeleton were unbroken kind of rules out that idea. So these some of the bones from the Castanedolo discoveries are in a museum of anthropology in Rome, and I've been in touch with the director of that museum. So they are some of the bones are still there, and it should be possible to go have a look at them. But the significance of the case is they are anatomically modern human bones, and they were found in layers of rock that modern geologists consider to be about 4 million years old, roughly the same age as the Laetoli footprints.
Amazing.
If you're enjoying this program and have been listening to other Earth Ancient podcasts, I'd appreciate it if you would support our sponsor, Gaia. And Gaia is a streaming website that has first-class programs on ancient civilizations, pyramid culture, sacred geometry, and hundreds of special programs, special series on ancient wisdom, cultures that have left the Earth, Atlantis. And then there's spirituality, wellness. Oh, I mean, there's this amazing programs. There's a whole series on NASA. And I really would appreciate it if you would support Gaia. And Gaia is offering Earth Ancient members a special offer for 99 cents for the first month. You can get full access to all these programs and many, many more, even the new programs. And to do that, go to Gaia.com/Earth Ancients. That's www.gaia.com/Earth Ancients. And when you support Gaia, you support Earth Ancients. We need your support to keep developing the best program on the internet. All things ancient of the earth, all things present, and even into the future. Join us, join Gaia, support Earth Ancients. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Here's one that I just am mind-boggling. It's the number four on your smoking guns is the Macoupin County skeleton, which dates 300 million years.
That's
amazing.
Really,
300 million years.
Yeah, it's another thing you're not going to read about in the textbooks, but if you dig back into the original scientific reports, you'll find it. There was a scientific journal called The Geologist, and in the year 1861, they published an interesting report. A human skeleton was found 90 feet below the surface of the ground in Macoupin County in the state of Illinois. It's near the city of St. Louis in the United States. And according to the report, above the skeleton was a thick layer of slate rock that was unbroken. And that's an important detail because it rules out the idea that somehow a skeleton slipped 90 feet down through the ground and, yeah, you know, and wound up in these very ancient layers of rock. So what we did is we got in touch with the State Geological Survey of Illinois. We asked them how old are the layers beneath the slate rock at that location in Macoupin County. And they said, well, those formations would be about 300 million years old. So it's mind-boggling in one sense. That's from before the time of the dinosaurs, even. But in terms of the view of human history that's presented in the ancient Vedic text of India, it's not surprising at all. Because according to those texts, we should expect to find a human presence going all the way back to the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth. And this is just one more example of the scientifically reported evidence that's consistent with that idea of extreme human antiquity. And of course, it just means everything we're reading in the textbooks today about human origins is not true.
Interesting. Okay, and number five, smoking gun, and the last one is the Rick skeleton, which is dated over 1 million years. Where is that located?
That is a skeleton that was found at a place called Olduvai Gorge in Africa. It's a very famous place. A lot of discoveries have been made there of different kinds of ape men. But the first discovery that was made at Olduvai Gorge is not so very well known. It was made by a German scientist named Hans Reck, and that's why I've called it Reck's skeleton. He found it in upper bed 2 of Olduvai Gorge in solid rock. He said it was so solidly embedded in the rock that he had to take it out with hammer and chisel. And according to modern geologists, upper bed 2 of Olduvai Gorge is over 1 million years old. And the skeleton is fairly complete. One problem is that the skeleton was kept in a German museum, and that museum was bombed during World War II. The skull was preserved, but much of the skeleton was lost. So this is just another example of evidence for an anatomically modern human presence going much further back in time than the current textbook ideas will allow. As I said, the modern ideas, humans like us, first appeared less than 200,000 years ago.
Interesting.
So there are hundreds of cases. These are just five, you know, that we chose to talk about. But there are actually hundreds of cases like this documented in my book, Forbidden Archaeology, which is about 900 pages long.
Yes, it is. It is very long. If you would like to call in and ask Michael a question, please do so. The number is 347-826-9565 and press 1 on your dial, and we will see you. Also, as our tradition, if you would like to write a question and post it on Facebook or Twitter, go right ahead. Facebook is earthancients.com, and Twitter is #EarthAncients, and we will see and receive your questions. Michael, I'm curious about any ancient technology, machines, or anything that's been uncovered from extreme antiquity that you can speak about. Now, I've seen photographs of small, they look like large ball bearings with interesting cuts in them that may have been manufactured by some machine. But do you have any examples of machines or mechanisms that are found next to any of these skeletons or even by themselves?
Yeah, that sort of thing doesn't preserve very well over long periods of time. There are some metal objects that have been discovered in some very ancient layers. Some of them are made of gold. One reason gold is considered valuable is it doesn't oxidize. Most other metals will oxidize, like iron will rust, for example, and most metals will kind of decay over long periods of time. But there was a case from Morrisonville, Illinois. It was reported in a newspaper called the Morrisonville Times in the year 1892. Told of a woman named Mrs. Robert W. Culp, who was putting a piece of coal into a coal-burning stove, and one of the pieces of coal was very big, so she broke it in half, and inside she found a gold chain about 10 inches long. And the coal from that mine, you know, from the report, we were able to tell what mine the coal came from. And it turned out that the coal from that mine was about 300 million years old. So that would be about the same age as the Macoupin County skeleton, also found in the state of Illinois, in deposits about 300 million years old. There was another case reported in Scientific American in the year 1852. It was a beautiful metallic vase. It's not a machine, but it was a metal object, a vase with very elaborate floral engraved patterns on it that was found 15 feet deep in solid rock at Dorchester, which is part of the Boston area in Massachusetts. And yeah, we got in touch with geologists from the United States Geological Survey and asked them about the age of the formations at that depth at that place, and they said, well, that's the Roxbury conglomerate, and it's about 600 million years old. So there are cases like that. There was also a case that, you know, like, I wish I could tell you, you know, I have some reports of machines from these very ancient layers, but there are reports of metal objects. I mean, there are some, you know, I think probably the oldest mechanism that's reported in the scientific literature is the Antikythera mechanism, which is something that was discovered in a Roman or a Greek shipwreck in the Mediterranean. But it's not so old. It's a few thousand years old. But it's like a computer-like metal geared machine for calculating star positions, eclipses, and things like that. But that's not extremely old. But to get back to some of the older things, metal objects that have been found, there was the case of the wolf's egg iron object that was found at a place called Schönbrunn in Austria. And it was an iron foundry there, and they were using coal to for the furnaces in this iron foundry. And a workman broke open a piece of coal and found an iron object shaped like an egg with a scalloped surface and a groove going all the way around it. It was obviously something that had been manufactured somehow, but the coal deposits in which it was found are about 10 to 12 million years old. So there are reports of metal objects that have been machined or manufactured being found in very, very ancient layers of rock. There are things like that.
Is there any reports of, like, gears or what we would call shafts, piston shafts, or anything that's, like, more shaped in some mold format that you've discovered, or any literature?
There are some reports of such things from Russia, but they're very difficult to verify. And we have to keep in mind that there's some fossils that actually resemble, you know, they're animal and plant fossils that actually resemble gears. So there are, occasionally you will see reports of such things, but unless you're able to verify them and check them, they're a little difficult to comment upon.
Okay, interesting. Okay, so I would like to quickly talk about an ancient city that was discovered off the coast of India called Dwarka, and then we're going to take a couple of questions from our audience and conclude. Can you tell us about Dwarka and... wasn't that the fabled city of Krishna?
Yes.
Yeah.
Of course, this is from more recent history. It's interesting the city existed about 5,000 years ago in northwestern India,
mm-hmm.
on the shore. And it said that it went under the water. And marine archaeology, I mean, there's a city called Dwarka even today in northwestern India on the coast of the Arabian Sea there. And divers have gone into the waters off the coast of the present city of Dwarka, and they have found remains of a sunken city there, which may be the remains of Krishna's city, which, according to the ancient Sanskrit text, went under the water 5,000 years ago. One of the reasons why I became interested in the city of Dwarka has to do with another interest of mine, the descriptions of spacecraft given in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. They're called by a Sanskrit word called Vimana. It means flying ship or spacecraft. And there was an elaborate description of how a demoniac king named Shalva got a spaceship made of iron or steel from an engineer of the demons. You know, according to the ancient Sanskrit text, you know, say this idea, you know, that we had in the Star Wars films of some cosmic battle between the forces of good and evil, you know, going on a cosmic scale. There, according to the Vedic text, that's a reality. There have been such things. There have been forces of light and darkness battling over the universe for a long time, and they have technology. So this king on Earth named Shalva, who was allied with these forces of darkness, got a spaceship from them, and he used it to attack Krishna's city of Dwarka. And he was shooting down weapons that, from the descriptions, resemble energy beam weapons. And the soldiers defending Krishna's city were trying to shoot this spaceship down, but they were finding it very hard to do because it was maneuvering in a very strange way. It was sometimes manifesting multiple images of itself. And this is something that is used in modern warfare. Say if an airplane, like one of, you know, an airplane is entering an enemy airspace, it will use electronic warfare to present false images of itself to the enemy's radar so they can't see which is the real image and which one to shoot down. So apparently technology like that was available, you know, thousands of years ago to some people here on Earth. But anyways, they were having a hard time shooting this craft down. Finally, Krishna himself had to use one of his weapons to shoot it down, and it crashed into the ocean off the city of Dwarka. So maybe there are some remains of a crashed UFO there or something like that. I mean, I talked about this case on the series Ancient Aliens that's aired on the History Channel over the past few years.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Dwarka is 5,000 years old. It's not really ancient.
But it should, according to their current understanding of the history of India, there shouldn't be a city like that there at that time, even 5,000 years ago.
So is it a sophisticated city, or is it just made up of huts and rudimentary walls?
According to the descriptions given in the ancient Sanskrit text, it was a beautiful city. You know, it was a fabulous city, you know, like something from, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a reference, but it was like a celestial city, basically. It was a magnificent city with huge avenues and parks and gardens and palaces and military defense structures, and wasn't just, you know, some huts.
Interesting. Fantastic. So we're going to take a couple questions now, and we're going to go to, let's see, John, this is from Facebook. John from Taos, New Mexico writes, do you have any concepts for human perception and the untapped ability to perceive beings in other dimensions? I guess he's referring to your study of the Vedic literature and human levels of consciousness and perceiving other dimensions. I think that's what he means.
Yes, I think we do have untapped powers of perception. And, you know, there are, and this may involve the ability to see beings from higher dimensions of reality. I think that is an ultimate possibility. And, you know, even in terms of modern science, there are some interesting experiments that have been done on extrasensory, you know, perception. You know, that, you know, showing that people are actually able to perceive things in ways that we can't really explain too well by our current scientific understandings. So, yeah, there have been scientific studies done on extrasensory perception. But I think these are abilities that we all have, and if we are able to develop our sensory powers, raise them to higher levels of perception, then we might be able to perceive beings from higher levels of reality who have the ability to remain invisible to normal human vision. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So is that a practice that is innate in our consciousness, or is it something that has to be developed through meditation? Or, I mean, I think there was a period in the 60s where people would take drugs like LSD and things like that to get that alternative state of consciousness. So are you saying, how do people develop that perception?
Well, it's apparently it's something that we all have in one form or another. It's like any other ability, like musical ability or mathematical ability. Everybody's got some, but some people have it developed to a higher extent than others. But, you know, once I was at a conference, a conference, it was actually in Canada, and there was a researcher there named Rupert Sheldrake, who has done some interesting experiments.
Yes.
And he was pointing out that this extrasensory ability is something that we all have. Like he said, and we all sense this. Sometimes you have the sense that somebody is staring at you, the back of your head or something, and you look around and, you know, there's somebody looking at you. And this can actually be tested. And at this conference, I participated in a little workshop where, there were about 100 people there. He divided us into groups of two, 50 pairs of two people, and then we would do it a little experiment where you sit in back of a person and you've got a list of instructions, 20 instructions. Stare at the back of the person's head, don't stare, 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 don't stare, stare, don't stare, you know, kind of randomly arranged. And the person sitting in front of you at each trial has to guess, is the person staring at the back of my head or not? And if there's no paranormal effect, then you would expect that people would get it right 50% of the time. Yeah, they would. But when you add it up, people get it right at 70 to 80% of the time. In other words, they've got some kind of extra sense. They've got eyes in the back of their head, so to speak, that let them know when. Or another thing, you know, that can be tested, that Rupert Sheldrake has tested, is sometimes, you know, your cell phone rings and you just know who it is. Yeah.
Hmm.
I mean, you just perceive somehow
there's a level of consciousness in place there that we don't talk about because it's not, we don't have the tools to test it or something there that is going on that is allowing us to perceive events and scenarios like that is what you're
saying. And then there are things like remote viewing, which the American military actually used in the 1970s and 80s to, I mean, there were things they couldn't see with spy satellites or whatever, and so they spent millions of dollars employing people with this remote viewing, this ability to see things at a distance. It's been admitted, you know, that they did this, and they still might be doing it. I mean, but the programs that went on in the 1970s and 80s, they've admitted they were using psychics and remote viewers to try to perceive what was going on in the Soviet Union and things like that.
Yeah.
So
that's interesting.
There are people who have developed these extrasensory abilities to a high degree.
Hmm. That's a whole another program, remote viewing. But yeah, that would be someone who's very sensitive. I guess it's a trainable ability is what remote viewing is. I'm not that familiar with it. Let's take one last question. This is from Mary in San Francisco, and she asks, Michael, when do you think knowledge filtration will stop? And both students and the public will hear alternatives to our current history.
Well, when people organize themselves to influence the curriculum formation process in the school systems, right now the supporters of the current dominant scientific theories have managed to convince government to give them a monopoly in the education system, which means only their theories can be taught. All the alternative theories are kept out. Not only are they kept out, they're actually criticized in very negative, dismissive ways. So I think that's not really how things should be. Of course, people have a lot of things on their mind now, you know, like wars and economic crises and things like that. But I think eventually, if people's attention could be focused on it, we should get some changes in the public tax-supported education system. Because I think in a country that considers itself free and democratic, we shouldn't allow government to give one group of scientists an absolute monopoly in the education system. It's like saying, I mean, okay, today let's admit most of the scientists, the majority of them, accept the current theories. All right, but there are others who oppose these theories and who are promoting alternatives. So I think the fair thing to do would be, all right, give the majority view, the majority of textbook pages and classroom time in the science classes, but in some small percentage of the textbook pages and in the classroom time, it should be acknowledged that there are alternative ideas, and these should be presented neutrally and objectively, not dismissively, and then let students make up their own minds about these things. But for that to happen, there's going to have to be some pressure from the vast majority of people on their political representatives to get alternatives into the education system. I think it's possible because the vast majority of the American people accept these paranormal things. They don't agree with many of the current scientific theories, but they're not focused on this now as a political issue. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, these
got
programs
other minds right now.
Yeah. But you're right. This program, Mystery of Man, and Ancient Aliens, has a monstrous viewing audience. So it's amazing. Well, Michael, it's been a pleasure having you on the program. just fascinating. Do you have a new book coming out soon, or what are you working on right now? I'm just curious.
Well, my most recent book just out is My Science, My Religion, which is a collection of 24 papers that I presented on all of these topics at major international scientific conferences. So many people are very amazed that I'm able to do that. I mean, they would say, okay, we're talking here on this show or maybe on Ancient Aliens on TV, but many people are surprised that I'm actually able to present these kinds of things at scientific conferences. So that book, My Science, My Religion, is a collection of the papers I've presented at scientific conferences on these topics. And it's scientific evidence that's consistent with the ancient Vedic teachings. And actually, the first 100 people that order a copy of that book will get a free copy of Bhagavad Gita, which is the primary Vedic text, in addition to the copy of my book. They'll get a free bonus copy of Bhagavad Gita. What I'm working on now is a book I'm calling More Forbidden Archaeology. There's a lot of cases that have come to my attention since the original book was published, and I'm gathering that material now and working on it and hope to have that out within a couple of years.
Okay. And for our audience, what is your website again? What is the address?
My personal website is mcremo.com, mcremo.com. Mm-hmm. My books can be ordered there. The free offer will be up on there. mcremo.com, okay. mcremo.com.
Perfect. Wonderful. And then when they order, they get the free other text.
Yeah, Bhagavad Gita, which is the
Bhagavad Gita. Right.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I appreciate you being on the program, and we will keep an eye on you and follow your work. And it's just fascinating. I think you're really breaking a tremendous amount of ground and so many people. I see references with Graham Hancock, Robert Bovall, all the people who are also kind of shaking the tree a little bit regarding ancient history. So I think we all will agree that your work is paramount in what they're doing. And I'm personally very interested in the work, too. So thank you, and appreciate you being on the program. So next week. Yes, thanks. It's fantastic. Next week we'll have an archaeologist from South America. He's a Dutch archaeologist who has discovered some fascinating structures in the Cusco and the Sacsayhuaman area, which is just above Cusco. And the ruins there, it's most famously known for their megalithic walls. We will talk to you all next time on...